You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to Not the Top 20 podcast. Yes, your ears are not deceiving you. This is George Ellick hosting this week with him, Ali Maxwell. We've got a special guest for this special podcast on squad planning and foreign recruitment in the EFL. It is Omar Chowdhury from 21st Group. Omar, you joined us a few months ago for one of these special pods. How have you been since?
I've been very good, thanks. My wife and I have had a small baby. Well, I suppose all babies are small. We've had a baby.
was your baby particularly small?
No, he wasn't actually. He was maybe, if anything, above average. So I don't know
why.
So
you've had
a
big baby.
I've had a big baby. And it's been a big life change. So I'm slightly tired. This is, we're recording in the afternoon. This is about the time of day where I start to flag. But I'm going to try and make as much sense as possible. And hopefully the listeners find it interesting.
I can say when you get to 16 months, there's no part of the day that you start to flag. You just flag from when you wake up until the end of the day. From one big baby to another, Ali, how are you?
Oh, come on. The first Not the Top 20 podcast that you've ever hosted. And you've started with such quality, such energy, some natural humour. It's sickening. This is actually quite a bad moment for me.
I did stumble on my words, my third word, so I wouldn't worry too much about me stepping in for you. If there's some like serious chemistry going on here, if you can tell that we all feel very comfortable with each other, that is because we've actually spent quite a lot of time together since we recorded the last pod as the three of us, because Ali and I have actually been working with 21st Group more formally since then. It's been a really fun partnership. We've been able to use our knowledge of the EFL, of the leagues, of the teams, of the players within the actual game itself. And it's kind of been the first opportunity for us to basically look behind the curtain and understand how clubs make decisions. So it's been insightful. And we've actually been involved in some really exciting projects with TFG over January with the transfer window and player recruitment. So we have a little bit of experience when it comes to this. And we're delighted to be able to kind of announce the fact that we've been working with 21st Group for the last few months. But talking about this is kind of a bigger subject. And for those who are listening who, you know, maybe didn't listen to the first pod or don't understand necessarily how data can be central to efficient player trading, and Omar, why a company like 21st Group, who are well established in the space, would look to a couple of guys without the experience within football operations industry in Ali and I to help you use that data to best practice.
Yeah, well, firstly, I don't think you guys should put yourselves down. I mean, you guys
Thank
know
you.
A lot about football, about the EFL, and that's part of the reason we started working together, is that you've got your own perceptions and knowledge that we were keen to tap into. And I think there's often a perception with data people that we're always very keen to give computer says no or computer says yes as the answer. And that can be further from the truth, both at TFG and I think more broadly, actually, for people using data within football. And so we, like others, like to supplement the insights that we get from the data with that on the ground, with that kind of experience, expertise, the sniff test, the eye test, everything else that comes from watching loads and loads of football that, frankly, people in spreadsheets and in code don't always get the time to do. So I think what data provides is the scale. And I think that's an underutilized and underappreciated part of data, is that you can look far and wide, go back many years, look at many clubs, which look at many leagues, which is what we'll do today. But the experts help provide that precision, that context, that those anecdotes, those stories, which actually are often the most compelling part of a piece of work. So, yeah, really enjoyed working with you guys over the last few months, and hopefully many more interesting projects to come.
Ali, the biggest surprise to me has been the fact you can't filter players worldwide around whether or not they're interested. I just assume that was a given when it comes to player recruitment. What has been your biggest... Well, what have been your biggest learnings, I guess, in the time that we've been working with TFG?
It's been amazing. Learnings being the key word. I think I've learned so much. And I mean, firstly, some of the data science is incredible. I feel sometimes a bit of a fraud because George and I and this podcast has often been sort of labeled as like, oh, the data guys, the guys that love their numbers. And while that's true, we are lovers of data and its use within sport and analysing football, but neither of us have any actual ability in building models or coding or anything of that nature. So to have seen the data science that TFG have, and Omar and his colleagues as well, is very, very cool, first and foremost. Learned loads, but also to feel like our input, which I guess in our case is contextual knowledge in particular, is valuable to a company like TFG that I've admired from afar for a long time, has been very cool. And then specific to the transfer market, I mean, my eyes have been opened to a big wide world, really, because like, we have a necessary narrow focus on the three EFL divisions in order to develop contextual knowledge to a certain level and to understand, you know, context as best as possible. And we haven't spread ourselves very thin. It means that my knowledge of European football and beyond had dropped significantly. But when you start working on projects such that we have, using data science, you know, to scout across the globe, it's been very, very cool. And we've had a few instances, George, where we've just been doing a bit of video scouting as a next layer on top of some data science work, initial filtering. And we've gone from watching players in South Korea to Chile to Serbia. And that's a real treat for football obsessives like us.
It's interesting you mentioned the South Korea part, because I've really enjoyed watching how teams in South Korea tend to seemingly go out and sign a 6'5" Brazilian striker who's only played regional football in Brazil, who then goes there and tears it up. So that is a trend that I'm fully behind. But I'm recording this towards the end of March. So whilst this is probably the only time in the season where fans aren't really thinking about transfers, because it's getting to the stage of the season where we're going to find out who gets promoted, who gets relegated, who's going to miss out on their aims. It's only probably the teams who are languishing in mid-table who are actually thinking far enough in advance for squad building. But why is it important that within clubs, what is best practice here? How do clubs need to plan in order to ensure that they are maximising their opportunities when it comes to player recruitment?
Yeah, so when you think about clubs, and increasingly in the EFL, it's been true in the Premier League for a while, they are more than obviously just the coaching staff and the players as a whole, and I guess performance staff on a match-to-match basis. There's a whole team of backroom staff who deal with the mid to long-term recruitment, being the obvious one, but obviously the academy side and then the sporting director overseeing all that, of which, again, a lot of EFL clubs now have. And at this point of the season, those members of staff can't influence anything. They can't sign any players. You know, an academy player's not likely to come through. There's no big strategic decisions you can make. Changing a head coach probably isn't going to make that much of a difference at this point of the season, as we discussed last time. So it's really about taking a more strategic view. And actually, if you're one of those types of people at a club, this is a great opportunity to now start thinking about next season. I think the temptation is, as you say, a lot of clubs have a lot of uncertainty at this point of the season. It's probably a third, maybe even a half of clubs that harbour some kind of hope of or hoping not to be in another division in some cases. So that uncertainty brings challenges around planning. You could say that about your own life, and that's certainly true in a football club. And so I think the temptation is almost to be a little bit tactical about things, saying, well, if we're in the Premier League or if we're in League One, this is what we might sign, this is what we might do. But actually, because there's so many things to be thinking about in those different circumstances, it can help to kind of take a step back and just do what we call, most often known in the kind of industry, this kind of what it takes to win analysis, like truly understand what do you actually need in that other division, or even within the existing division, if you weren't to get promoted or relegated, to to stay up, go up, have success in that league. And that can relate to the squad size, the playing style, the profiles, the traits of the squad that you need. And a lot of clubs, I think, don't do that. They tend to recruit quite tactically and think about recruitment quite tactically. And at this time of the season, they might have lots of different lists and lots of different players. And I think the key is trying to have some sense of guiding principles of, if we're to get promoted, these are the five things that we're looking for in players. If we were to get relegated, these are the four things that we need to be focusing on. And that's particularly true in the EFL, particularly when you've got so many short-term contracts and so on. You need to be nimble, but with a bit of a framework and a plan in mind.
And in terms of kind of specifically within this pod and within the work that we do, particularly, you know, around the UK market and the EFL itself, like, what is the issue that we're trying to solve here? Because it's definitely felt like in the last couple of windows, we've seen massively inflated prices for players who, it feels like only a couple of seasons ago, wouldn't have even commanded a fee, at suddenly being touted for huge prices within the EFL itself. Is there an argument here that because we've seen the data revolution in football trickle down now, realistically, most EFL clubs are going to have some kind of data access and probably quite similar access, and probably the same players can be flagged across the board, that it's now very, very hard to use data to get a head start within English football?
I think that's probably true. At the end of the day, recruitment teams, sporting directors working within the EFL will know the EFL very well, and will also know probably to a degree how the EFL leagues translate with each other. So if you're signing a player in League One from League Two, you probably have a pretty decent sense of his potential to step up, and therefore the opportunity for an edge is much smaller because that knowledge is shared. And I also think, to your point around the inflated fees, is that increasingly clubs are seeing, I can't grow my match day income because my stadium's only so big and it costs a lot of money to expand it, and I don't want the ticket prices up. It's very hard to draw sponsorships. You know, a lot of these clubs are very hyper-local or regional at best, and therefore you're not going to attract, you know, big global sponsors to your team. It's only going to be kind of local companies. And your broadcast income, well, you're at the mercy of the EFL there and the deals that they negotiate. And yes, that's going to go up, but it's still going to be spread pretty thinly across a lot of clubs, and therefore it's not going to be transformative to a lot of teams. So transfer income is the means by which you can grow your revenues pretty quickly. And so I think ownership is becoming much more savvy about that. And that is in turn meaning you negotiate harder, you think harder about your player trading strategy, which drives up prices within the EFL as well. So I think that's all contributing to inflation. And if you look at the numbers, about 90% of EFL recruitment is from UK leagues. So that includes the likes of Scotland and Ireland, where there have been some success stories. But even then, you know, it's still a relatively small market. And if you look at the Championship itself, I'll get into how we rate leagues and compare leagues, but we rate the Championship on average to be a similar standard to, say, the Belgian Pro League or the Danish Superliga. But wages are about 20% higher than in those two leagues. League One is a similar standard to the Slovakian top division, but wages about three times higher, about 70% higher than what they are in Sweden. And that's ultimately a function of the English market. There's so much money in English football, and spending more or you know, giving your centre forward a pay rise doesn't necessarily make him a better player, but you might need to make that pay rise in order to keep him in the team and stop him going to another team. And so the English market is naturally inflated. It's not necessarily a criticism of the clubs. It's just a nature of the market. Although the smart clubs are beginning to think about, well, how do I find a way of getting closer to the Slovakian wages rather than those League One wages?
I think as well that because so much of a club's transfer strategy is based in making profit down the line in mind in the EFL, for the reasons that Omar just mentioned, a lot of clubs won't even entertain the idea of signing a player, perhaps a striker in particular, over a certain age. And the reality is that the leagues themselves, let's say League One and League Two, feeding into the Championship, there's actually a very small number of eligible players. Let's look at strikers, for example. If you're looking for a striker and you're a Championship club, it's natural to look at League One and League Two and try and get the best talent that you can find there, because it seems like that, you know, that's the way that things work, right? But if you look at this season in League One and League Two, a list of strikers that are younger than 26, so not even like under 21s, under 23s, under 26, who are not loanees from the Premier League or the Championship, and have played over 1,800 minutes. Now, that's only 20 games worth of minutes. It is amazing and quite stark how few there are, really. So in League One, Mark Harris, Raul Sotiriou, Ricky J. Jones, Sam Smith, Victor Adeboyejo, Big Kelvin from Reading, George Lloyd as well. And then in League Two, Will Evans, Isaac Alafe, Aqua of Barrow, Harvey Saunders of Tranmere, and Al Hamady was the one. And that's why Al Hamady was the name to talk about in the EFL transfer window, because any club in the Championship in particular who thought they wanted a number nine and looked beneath them in English football saw incredibly few names that felt particularly interesting or like solid, viable options for them. And that's why I think we're seeing, now that the market's opened up a bit post-COVID with financial uncertainty being lessened, thankfully, that's why I think so many of the signings from abroad this summer were strikers or wide forwards and that sort of thing. Over 50 signings from outside the UK into the Championship, and 55% of them were either strikers or wide forwards or number 10 types. So it's about supply and demand as well.
This is an advertisement for NordVPN.
George, you recently became a father. Does your daughter listen to Not the Top 20?
Well, she's only just turned one, so it's a bit early for her to be into football. But we also do try and keep her off devices. It's a scary world out there, and when she gets older, the last thing we want is for our daughter to be vulnerable to some of the dark corners of the internet.
Yeah, I can see that. In that case, you should protect your whole household with one NordVPN account, including all of your shared gadgets and devices. You'll also be alerted if your personal details come into hackers' hands and can browse in peace of mind knowing that NordVPN does not track your online activities.
That all sounds great, but what if she's throwing a tantrum abroad because she's desperate to watch an episode of Miss Rachel?
Well, NordVPN has you covered there too, as you can access your home content while travelling.
Sign up to NordVPN today at nordvpn.com/NTT20. It's risk-free with NordVPN's 30-day money-back guarantee. Plus, as part of their birthday celebrations, you'll receive 4 months extra and a bonus gift. But it's interesting there, Ali, that you mentioned the players going into the Championship, because frustratingly we can't get into the specifics necessarily of what we've worked on with TFG, but there's been, you know, we've worked with one club in a European league where you don't see much action coming into the UK. But as Omar mentioned, the wages for players who TFG models have as being, you know, League One players or bottom Championship players are minuscule in comparison to what clubs are playing at the level. Yet we kind of learnt in that there was maybe a reticence from clubs to take what is perceived to be a risk on these players. And in the way my mind works, I'm like, hold on, what's the risk here? Is the risk going and spending top tier wages on proven talent, proven meaning they're available and you're able to get hold of them? Or is the risk taking less of a chance in terms of financial outlay with a much higher reward ceiling? Like, you mentioned the Championship there, Ali, but there are players available in a multitude of leagues in League One and League Two who are not going into those leagues. We're not seeing those clubs recruit in those areas. We saw loads of teams in League One who are desperate for a striker. We saw Oxford and Charlton go head-to-head for Will Goodwin from Cheltenham, who had about 4 months' worth of EFL football to go off for just shy of £500,000. Why do you think it is that clubs are kind of still unwilling to take that plunge, even though recruitment from foreign leagues is now incredibly common at elite level and pretty common at Championship level?
If we're looking at League One and League Two, you are absolutely right, by the way. No one apart from Barnsley is signing players from outside the UK in League One and League Two. Barnsley with Mael Dejavigny in the summer, with Big Donovan Pines in January. They are still the most creative team in terms of recruiting from abroad outside of the Championship. And even when they're in the Championship, they stood out at that level for doing the same. Reading did actually sign some players last summer from foreign leagues, which, given the situation around the club, I just cannot understand who's doing the scouting there and who's pulling the trigger. But some of them have been, you know, quite good additions. But yeah, in League One, League Two, no one's buying from abroad. And yeah, in terms of understandable reasoning, budgets are smaller. You are making the point. Omar would make the point. I would agree that you don't have to spend a lot to shop outside the UK. It doesn't have to mean spending a lot of money, but I think the perception might be there that you do. Also, the average contract length is shorter. and the transfer fees that League One and League Two clubs can demand are so much lower than Championship clubs, it means there's a little bit less upside attached to the perceived risk, I think, of bringing in a player from abroad. I do find it weird that the behaviours, the transfer market behaviours, are so different in League One and League and the Championship. As if when you get promoted to the Championship, like a video game, you unlock this ability or this skill to buy from abroad. That, you know, there are no such barriers actually in place. And I think a lot of this sort of barrier, as I've described it, just comes down to English football, like so much of society, being about trends, being about, you know, things that are normal or accepted or otherwise. And because there are so few League One and League Two clubs doing it, that means there's not a lot for people to see and sort of latch on to. Once they are visible, it doesn't take long for others to follow suit. So I do think it's probably as much about norms and trends and not wanting to be the ones that stick your neck out and get it wrong and look silly. It sounds stupid, like that shouldn't impact the decision making within individual clubs, but I do believe it does to an extent.
I think there's an element as well of, if you sign from within the EFL and it doesn't go right, there's probably a reason you signed them in the first place, and there are probably a few other clubs after him. And yes, he might have overpaid, but there's probably an exit market. Now, I think the one thing I would say is that you've probably overpaid, so the wages make it quite hard to exit well there, because a player who, if he was in high demand, goes to call it a Championship club, doesn't perform well, he's going to be on much higher wages. League, probably not going to drop down to League One. It makes it quite challenging, but at least there is some demand there. I think that's a challenge with international recruitment. If you've identified a player that no one else is looking at and he turns out to be a dud, which can be the case, like, we're not saying that, you know, international recruitment's a panacea for clubs. It can be a little harder to exit, but the upside is they're probably on lower wages. And that is, I mean, we see this all the time with Premier League clubs in particular, who make high, you know, expensive signings, and it's just they end up sending them out on loan and paying 60-70% of their wages. It's going to be less so the case if you manage to sign someone who's perhaps a little bit undervalued, even if they didn't turn out to work out well.
And obviously the kind of rules around foreign transfers have changed in the last couple of seasons. You know, it was a closed market for a while. That's not the case anymore. So for those listening who don't understand what is possible for EFL clubs, could you just talk us through it?
Yeah, it was worth going back to the heady days of 2015-16 when Brexit was just...
Glory years.
Exactly, yeah. Brexit, we thought we'd come and go.
The glory years of 2015-16, that's Leicester City. Is that not everyone's first thought? Leicester City.
Absolutely.
I was thinking it was the last season before we started doing the podcast, wasn't it? So that was also the glorious.
The glory years for EFL fans, not having us wittering on at them.
Well, Leicester City was a great example. Leicester City were able to sign N'Golo Kanté and Riyad Mahrez from Ligue 2 in France. And that was because they could sign anyone from any club inside the EU, because free movement of people enabled clubs to do that. And clubs would, I'd say, generally happily recruit from the EU. But there were, you know, plenty of teams that didn't, you know, clubs... In the Premier League and down the EFL only allowed 17 international players. Didn't mean that they necessarily always filled all those slots, but they had the opportunity to sign from within the EU. And then actually signing from outside the EU was quite challenging. The player had to be a fairly established international. And if they were, then odds are they weren't going to the EFL. They were probably going to the Premier League, your Brazilians and Argentinian players. So that obviously changed with Brexit, and in the short term actually made it very, very challenging for EFL clubs, because a lot of the Brexit... regulations around work permits were framed really around a Premier League argument. There was a lot of debate between the FA and the Premier League about the number of English players within the Premier League and therefore the number of international players that should be quote-unquote allowed into the league. So there's a relatively high bar set for Premier League clubs, and you can obviously appreciate that that is a particularly high bar for Championship, let alone League One and Two clubs. And I think there were a few clubs in the Championship, who were pretty innovative with their international recruitment, that were none too pleased with seeing, say, leagues like Denmark and others that were ranked relatively lowly in terms of players had to be truly outstanding in those leagues rather than, you know, good players coming across. So there was a relatively high bar, but in the last 9 months or so, there's been a rule change called ESC places, Elite Significant Contribution places, which enables essentially clubs now within the EFL to sign anyone from a select group of leagues, what's known as band 1 to 5 leagues. So your band 1 and 2 leagues are your big 5 leagues, Belgium, Netherlands, Brazil and others. Band 5 leagues are a bit more fruity, one might say. So Japan, Korea, as two leagues that historically English clubs haven't recruited from, because again, pre-Brexit, it would have been quite challenging to recruit from those markets. So part of the FA's argument is that we're giving you access to new leagues. But even leagues like Chile, Uruguay, Serbia, Hungary, Sweden are now open for business for VFL clubs. So clubs can sign anyone from these leagues, provided that they've essentially, you know, played some professional football in these leagues. And that that is an exciting, I think, opportunity for EFL clubs, because suddenly they can start looking at markets that perhaps other teams aren't looking at.
And in fairness, Ali, that's happened previously. Like, we're not reinventing the wheel here. It's not like EFL clubs have never exploited deficiencies in certain markets or leagues where players are undervalued, is it? What are some examples where we've already seen the EFL clubs make the most of this?
This is not to do with Brexit or ESC slots, but clearly in Leagues 1 and 2, there's been a massive acceleration in recruiting directly from Ireland, for example. The League of Ireland has contributed to, you know, the first team squads of Lincoln City and Fleetwood quite significantly, in particular in the last couple of years. And we've seen a lot of clubs jumping on that bandwagon as a result. I think, again, because of trends, people are looking at the Irish market and what's been a really impressive decade of talent development over there, and that's having a big impact. Irish recruitment hasn't really impacted the Championship yet. It's yet another reason why separating the Championship and League One, League Two in these discussions is quite important, because some things can be true for League One and League Two that aren't true for the Championship. So Owen Toll of Bolton is possibly the most successful so far. I mean, Jack Moylan's made an amazing start for Lincoln. Danny Mundroy and Dylan Duffy, a big part of their squad as well. Half of Fleetwood's team, it seems, have come from League of Ireland. And of course, that, you know, they've had relationships with clubs over there through their ownership as well, but not yet an impact on the Championship. Adam Murphy joining Bristol City in January, that's kind of an interesting one to watch. And Emaku as well, who went to Millwall, who we've seen snippets of. I think in terms of other markets that have been successfully exploited, there's so much that can go into the success or otherwise of players that it's difficult to really isolate and highlight examples. What I will say, which might be interesting, is that if you look at the Championship and you break it down by player nationality, the fifth most abundant nation represented outside England, Scotland, Wales and the Republic of Ireland is the Netherlands. Dutch players are voluminous in the Championship. And actually, if you look at an article that I wrote with the incredible help of Andy Watson, who is someone who has about as much knowledge on Brexit regulations, on ESC slots, on EFL recruitment from abroad as anyone else on the planet, and helped write a piece on NTT20.com a few months ago. One of the findings of his data analysis was that generally players that have been lifted from the Dutch divisions into the EFL, into the Championship, have performed pretty well. We got Denmark in eighth as well. So there's quite a lot of Danish players as well. But really all over, George. I mean, there's some quite interesting ESC slot usage over the last 12 months. Norwich signed two players, Vicente Reyes, who's now on loan at Forest Green, and Pedro Lima from South America, both under 23s using ESC slots. So not signing for their first team. Creative use of it for sure. In terms of using up an ESC slot once they became available, less than half of Championship clubs actually used one last summer. So not all teams hit the shops, but some of them were kind of ahead of the game. So Stoke and Sunderland and Blackburn, they all signed multiple first team players using ESC slots. And in terms of the best ones, I guess, that you look at so far, so guys who were signed last summer, 2023, that would not have been able to be signed the year or two before. Wouter Berger, probably Stoke signing. He came from Switzerland. That's band 4. Mads Frokjær Jensen and Mads Hermansen, who signed for Preston and Leicester, they came from Denmark, which is also band 4. So those, I would say, are probably the standouts. And then one other trend that I'm interested in, there have been 3 Japanese players signed into the Championship in the last few years. and three South Korean players signed into the championship in the last year or two. And I would say broadly, all of them have been pretty successful, have been impressive, good, positive additions, whether it's Junho Bae of Stoke, Pike, who signed into Birmingham in January, and then the Japanese players Miyoshi, Sakamoto and Nakayama. And I do wonder if, you know, and Omar will know more about the movement of players from those nations direct to England. But I think it's a little easier than it used to be. And if my belief is that trends are quite important here, I wouldn't be surprised if other championship clubs are looking at nations like Japan and South Korea and, you know, thinking maybe more so than ever before, there's players here and we need to be trying to sign directly from these leagues rather than waiting for them to take the step to the Netherlands or Belgium, as has been quite normal previously.
Absolutely. And it can be as silly, if you like, as seeing Japan do really well at the World Cup as it did in 2022. And
that was that Senegalese arrival in the Premier League, wasn't there, after 2002, suddenly. It does happen, doesn't it, after every major tournament.
Exactly. And you can overreact. You know, El Hadji Diouf did not exactly tear up the Premier League. But yeah, it could be that. And also we've seen a lot of Japanese, I mean, Scotland's up. You could do another whole other pod on Scotland and the regulations there and how it does or doesn't undercut the English market. But they've been able to recruit players from, for example, Japan, who have done really, really well there. So yeah, I think fundamentally there are now options for clubs that didn't exist before. And I think the smart clubs will think about the ESC places. We didn't go into this, but you're allowed a certain number of ESC places based on the amount of minutes you give to homegrown players. If you're a championship club in League One and Two, it's fixed. But I think the smart clubs will think about how we're using those places and not just, you know, using them willy-nilly, either perhaps using them to recruit really young players. So you can recruit down to the age of 18. Let's say you might want to go, okay, let's get, you know, 18-year-old who's just breaking through in Uruguay as an example, and have a bit of a bet there. Or you might go, actually, these are slots we can use to bring in a bit of experience. Maybe someone who's been a kind of leader in a Dutch club for a number of years, or perhaps Sweden or whatever it is, and can come in and add something else to the dressing room that you might be lacking. So I think clubs need to think a bit strategically about how they use the places rather than just going, oh, it's a player that we like, but he doesn't quite meet the benchmark. Let's go recruit him. I think it's nice to think of it in strategic terms, and therefore be a bit more deliberate about how you use the places.
And to kind of lift the hood up a bit on, you know, the insight that you guys can provide, if, as I'm sure has been the case before, you were to speak to a club who you were working with or working for, and there was clear reticence to recruit from, whether it's a perceived minor European league or whether it's a Japanese league or wherever, whether that's because of the perceived risk of the signing or whether that's because of the logistical issues, I guess, for bringing players over, or the referencing about their personality, like all these things are going to making a signing. What would you guys be able to show in order to inform, you know, whether the perceived risk is actually correct?
Yeah, so, I mean, firstly, domestic signings have risk associated with them as well. Anytime you sign a player from the EFL or a British player or whatever it is, there's a chance that he doesn't work out. And if you look at players signed domestically versus from international leagues, playing time doesn't really differ. It's pretty similar from different leagues. Obviously, you perhaps tend to remember the ones that came from overseas that failed. They can sometimes become kind of laughingstock names, or remember him, because, as I say, they didn't previously have a track record in the EFL, so they've become a bit of a walking joke. But on average, don't play any different level of minutes than domestic signings. And fundamentally, when we look at, we've done research to essentially look at, okay, well, how do we predict playing time in a league or for a particular team? And the single biggest driver of predictive of playing time is the level at which they're coming from. So clearly, if you're signing, you know, from a higher league, that player will tend to play more minutes, and that will probably because they're slightly come at a slightly higher cost. And that's fairly obvious if you're in the EFL, if you're signing from League One, a championship stalwart. But the key is then understanding what does a higher league look like in other markets, where I don't quite have a grasp of the quality in the same way that I might do within the EFL. And that's where data can really help, because when you're watching a league, you can gauge the quality within itself, who the good teams are, who the bad teams are. But when you're comparing across league, particularly in Europe, where the top team and the bottom teams in European leagues can be miles apart, like really, really miles apart, it can actually be quite hard to gauge the quality of those leagues in a kind of absolute terms, and therefore how a player might translate from one league to another.
Now, we're not going to ask you to give away the crown jewels, but there may be some decision makers at League Two clubs, at League One clubs, at Championship clubs who are listening to this podcast. What leagues are there out there that TFG Insights suggest are maybe worth pursuing, or parts of leagues where, you know, the quality gap, or the, where there's no quality gap really with where they'll be going into in the EFL, but there's clear value for money?
Yeah, you alluded to it there. I think the key thing is to think about it in terms of segments of leagues rather than leagues. So you often talk to heads of recruitment or sporting directors, and they say, oh, we'll think about the Scandinavian market, we'll think about the Netherlands or Belgium. But actually, the Netherlands is a great case study of a league that is, from top to bottom, huge differences. So top of the Eredivisie, you know, at the moment, that would be PSV or Feyenoord. They're obviously top 10 Premier League level. I mean, Ajax at their best in 2019 would have been comfortably a top six Premier League team at the time. So you've got the top teams at top Premier League level, but then you get down to Championship level and League One level, and the worst team wouldn't even win League Two. So that gives you a sense of when Ajax are playing Volendam or whoever it is at the bottom of the division, you do see these kind of 6-7-0 wins. It's to be expected, because it's a bit like, I don't know, Aston Villa playing Notts County, for example. That's the kind of gap that we're talking about in these leagues. So the average team is about Championship level in the Eredivisie, but you wouldn't kind of treat it as a whole market. And then if you think about the ESC place in your League One, League Two teams, somewhere like Chile, the top two teams are off Championship level, the rest are of League One level. So if you're a League One team looking at Chile, you might kind of disregard the top two teams. And traditionally, the top teams in the league like that will always attract a lot of interest, because they'll tend to have the best academies and hoover up a lot of players and so on. There might be players, and even older players, that might be of interest from those leagues, that if you've got the right kind of infrastructure around it, can help you recruit them. Hungary, the top team's nearly Premier League level, but then about 70% of the league is League One level, about 30% is top of League Two level. Similar story in Sweden. So then the broad thing is that pretty much any professional league has some overlapping quality with the EFL at some level. There's very few leagues out there. You really have to go into pretty niche leagues where there isn't some player or some teams that don't overlap with EFL quality. Of course, many of them are in that kind of band six category where you can't recruit from them. But some of these players might have youth international caps for a random country that might be of interest. And this is, again, goes to the point we discussed right at the top, the role of data. Data gives you that scale. You're just not going to know about all these players from your network and from watching football. But data can help alert you to all these players and give you a sense of the entire market, which you're just not going to get from traditional means.
That aspect of the change of the rules, meaning that youth international caps can now make a player available who ordinarily would not be available, has led to some amazing scouting missions and operations. As you can imagine, the first international break of the season, in fact, any international break, imagine the excitement of going through the squads pretty much worldwide and trying to identify who's making their first appearance, who is therefore potentially available that wasn't, and then scouting them to work out if they are an interesting or viable option for you. Of course, it's a long shot. It's a massive long shot, and it feels a little bit sort of Football Manager, doesn't it, rather than real life. But it is the reality for a lot of people that work for these clubs, because many of them are willing to be creative. They are not willing to just shut off outside the UK because it might be a little bit hard and there's a few more uncertainties that they don't know about. They are looking at these guys because they want to be the ones to, you know, steal a march on their rivals. And I think ultimately that's a lot about what we're talking about. Is it's a way of looking at the world, isn't it? You know, yes, there are reasons why signing someone from a league where very few signings have been made into your own division, where each division in each nation has its own culture, its own tactics, pitches and refereeing play a part in how recruitment folk think about other leagues. You know, weather can have an impact as well. These do have an impact, and they are quite hard to measure. And there are some who think, well, because of that, I'm not going to bother. There's a lot of people who would say that's still not a reason not to do that. Although recruitment is about minimizing risk, it's also about being brave. And I think it's in being brave and understanding how to aim for upside while keeping the risk as low as you can, you know, that's where I think the best and most exciting recruitment can be done.
On that risk point, mitigating the risk isn't hard in order to give yourself the best chance of the upside. So if you take an EFL club and the kind of steps they could take to get a bit more confident to recruit internationally, I think the first point is getting the data to ID. And I think also one of the challenges of the data is that you could look at a player in Bulgaria or Hungary and they could look great on the stats, but the challenge is you're like, well, the quality of the opposition, as we've spoken about before, isn't very good. So how do we adjust for that? And that's a big part of what we specialize in at TFG, is trying to get the kind of translations across leagues correct and trying to evaluate everyone on the same scale. So yeah, trying to get data because you need that scale, but looking at the right data. I think then obviously there is a network point. You need to have trusted people on the ground, trusted agents and so on. And that can be work, that can be hard to build up, but it's an edge you can create. You know, it's relationships, it's time, and it's building that confidence in other people, which, you know, good heads of recruitment and sporting directors will do. I think there's an element of just trying to look past your own biases. It's interesting, we worked a number of years ago with the Canadian Premier League, and one thing they were keen to do was export players to other leagues, and they were super hot on making sure that the stadium looked good, the broadcast footage looked good, everything kind of around the product looked good, so that when scouts in Europe were watching the game on Y-Scout, it actually didn't look like some amateur competition, because frankly, the pitch does have, you know, if it's next to a farm or whatever, it can look like, you know, a farmer's league, when it might not actually be. And that we're all biased in that. We're all, you know, we all have instinctive reactions to when we see something. So try and look past that if you can. Try and look past some of the kind of issues that you might see in that respect. And then finally, look, there is an issue around integration. Like, you know, all of us, if we were to move country tomorrow, we wouldn't find it easy on day one, particularly to a country where perhaps we didn't speak much of the local language. But there are things you can do, and there are traits of players that you can look at. I mean, we work with an EFL team that would consider itself a kind of working class town, like a lot of EFL teams would be, and think, oh, is someone from Scandinavia or is someone from Belgium really going to kind of settle in here? It's kind of culturally very different. But every country around the world has working class towns, has towns that might not be a world away from the town which your football club is in, and actually they might find some kinship. They might share a lot of the values that your supporters share, that other players in your team share, and those types of values can be universal. So it doesn't, all of this is risk mitigation, and nothing's going to guarantee a success. But if you can gain a bit of confidence on that, you will be looking in different ponds or fishing in different ponds to other clubs. And that's some level of competitive advantage.
Yeah, it's galling to hear you say to ignore your biases, because I'm now just going to bring up Ruben Rodriguez, who plays for Oxford. But he's just, in my opinion, one of the most pertinent examples here of a club just using some innovative recruitment. And, you know, Notts County were a National League side when they signed Rodriguez, and his, you know, he was a Portuguese player who'd spent the 18-19 season on loan at De Treffers, who are an amateur side in the top amateur league in the Netherlands. Then played 19-20, played in the Eerste Divisie, so the second Dutch league for Den Bosch. But for Notts County to recruit him out of that, you know, that was effectively unheard of. And he proved to be the best player in the National League in his final season, and was, you know, alongside Macaulay Langstaff, the main reason why they were able to get promoted out of the National League. And now he's a top-end League One player at the age of 27. And it's not the case where, in my mind at least, like, oh, well, he's the one that worked out. It's just that he's the one. Like, there are very few examples of clubs actually taking these chances. I think we'll close by just thinking about, you know, you mentioned there, Omar, around what clubs have to do in terms of building, whether it's an infrastructure at the club or the relationships necessary in order to be effective in this space. Ali, do you think there are many EFL clubs currently who are doing this well, who are, you know, whether it's the squad planning aspect, whether it's, you know, consistently, we've mentioned Lincoln already from Ireland, they seem to have that kind of nailed down. Are there any others you can think of?
It's hard to identify loads of clubs who we can say definitively have absolutely nailed squad planning and foreign recruitment. The obvious one that springs to mind is Brentford. They are not part of our parish anymore, and they've gone beyond us quite far. So,
but they were.
They were, for sure. And clearly, you know, I always use the food chain analogy when I talk about the transfer market and what clubs are able to do. And Brentford is still the case study for raising your clubs, placing the food chain via player trading. And I can't think of many other clubs who can so specifically be able to point to that aspect and say, we nailed it. I suppose in the Championship right now, you'd look at Coventry City. We've been loving their recruitment over the last few years. And clearly, Gyökeres and Gustavo Hama are the standouts. But they're not the only ones as well. And it's not just foreign recruitment where they've thrived, albeit they've shown an ability to do it well multiple times, which normally is a suggestion of very good processes and decision making. Van Evick, the right wing back, has been excellent this year from the Dutch league. Of course, Hadji Wright as well has adapted pretty well, to be honest, albeit at a very, very high price point. So Coventry are the ones. But I think the point to make is it's not just about buying players. So it's not just about talent ID. And it's not just about getting deals done. Selling players is also crucial to this discussion. So this is where squad planning, more specifically than talent identification and recruitment, is such a necessary part of this conversation. Selling players is crucial. Staying on top of contract extensions and your incumbent players is crucial. That is not extending them too far so that your squad gets a bit clogged up, but certainly not leaving yourself short and losing players, as Omar said, who could be very solid contributors that are going to cost a lot of money to replace, even if you might not think that they are your key men, your star men. And also, over the long term, you don't need to win, quote unquote, every single transfer window. You don't need to fill every window with sexy, shiny, flashy signings. And Coventry are a good example of this because summer 2023, lots of flashy, exciting signings, many of whom performing very well. 2 years before that, you've got Gyökeres and Hama. Unbelievable signings, transformative signings. But summer 2022 didn't do a huge amount of permanent business, a lot of loans. And if you look at the squad now, only Casey Palmer is contributing now to Coventry City 18 months down the line that signed in summer 2022. So again, I think A, that points to the fact that you don't need to win every single transfer window, but also that's where squad planning is crucial. And sometimes the best thing to do is not to go out and sign a player because you may have players in the building already who can actually do a perfectly good job if you can avoid the excitement of a shiny new signing. The last thing I'll say about Coventry is, of course, it's impossible to not to view this all through the Mark Robbins lens as well. That being that Coventry, more so than any other club in the EFL, alongside good player ID and recruitment and squad planning, have had someone in charge showing incredibly steady and consistent management, being very patient with players, clearly being open to players being signed from abroad, which I dare say some managers struggle a little bit more with, and being open to bedding them in slowly and giving them a chance and giving them time. So Coventry, the one that sprang to mind for me. But even in answering that, as you can tell, it's not straightforward. It's not simple.
And Omar, to close, I mean, Ali's done a pretty good job of it there, but how would you summarise the benefits of, you know, of squad planning and of having a clear plan, and what kind of advice, I guess, would you give to clients in terms of ensuring that they're in the best position to do so?
Yeah, look, every club has usually a whiteboard, maybe a PowerPoint presentation of essentially a squad depth chart. So each position you would see who's our kind of first choice player, second choice player, maybe academy players coming through if they're doing it well. I think the biggest challenge is you might have that for one season, you might have it mapped out for two seasons, but it often goes out the window when form turns, manager changes, new manager wants a new centre forward, whatever it is. And I think that kind of trusting of the process is key, and having a strong team behind the manager, whether it's a sporting director, head of recruitment, whatever it is, to make sure that the plan is kept in place. But ultimately, the main thing you're trying to do with squad planning is allow for value growth. So you've got players who are first choice at the moment, they get sold on, your second choice just comes through, is able to take the place of the first choice player, grow in value, and you're able to sell them on. And that creates ultimately the money that you need in order to invest to get promoted. Because as we spoke about right at the top, it's very difficult to grow money to invest in the squad. And the best way of doing that is through player trading. So I think, yeah, being able to set yourself up for player sales is a massive part of the squad planning process. And then just lastly, on the point Ali made around not every signing is successful. The stat I come back to a lot is the average club record signing plays 55% of minutes in their first season, which is crazy when you think about it. You know, they sit on the sideline for almost half of the games. And so if you could just turn that to 60% on average or 65% on average, you're getting yourself a few more games of a really good player. And that could be transformative for a team, particularly in the EFL where the margins are so fine. So there are huge inefficiencies in the market. Smart clubs, we've already seen them exploit those inefficiencies and get themselves higher in the league table than what their wage bill or their budget would suggest. So yeah, that's the appeal of international recruitment. It just needs to have a bit of confidence and a bit of risk mitigation. I think you can be really successful.
Really interesting stuff. I'm off to go and buy a couple of players from Chile as soon as we're off this call now. But thank you very much to Ali, and thank you to Omar from 21st Group for sharing your thoughts. Loved hosting this special episode. Maybe we'll do another one again in a few months' time. Ali and I'll be back on the betting show on the feed on Thursday as usual.